And you miss out again and again and again. When this new rule was put in place, I came home fuming. One of the early delights of marriage was having a husband to talk to about these issues. I never knew how much I wanted that until I had it. Sometimes it was less than delightful, though. Buddy, who has a background running his own money management firm, would sometimes defend John and the other managing partners.
"We probably don't know the full story," Buddy said.
"Oh, I know the full story," I said. "The full story is called, What the Hell Do They Think They're Trying to Pull?" But it was good to have that reality check from time to time, and it made me consider whether I might be overreacting. Buddy was coming from the perspective of a person who runs things, and I was coming from the perspective of a person who's used to troubleshooting problems in the system. I sucked it up and kept going to work and doing my best to make a difference. Still, every day I had to fight just to be kept in the loop on my own projects. "Why am I being kept away from the company we're working with together?" I finally asked Chihua one day, giving three examples of ways I had been excluded.
"Everybody knows you don't work well with people," he said bluntly.
"Who is everybody?" I asked, stunned, and thinking if anyone had a bad reputation for getting along with people, it was him, not me. Even people outside Kleiner complained about his arrogance and behavior. One CEO, who told me he viewed the world through a Star Wars filter and sorted people into a good guy team and a bad guy team, said that Chihua was one of the worst of the stormtroopers.
"Randy came up with a strategy of not inviting you because you have sharp elbows. Trey and Wen," Chihua declared, "told me not to work with you."
"It would be nice if you could talk to me about that," I replied, "and we could figure out a way to work together."
"You're too hard to work with,"
he insisted again. "How would you know?" I said calmly, though I was disappointed. Randy was supposed to be my mentor. I hadn't had any problems with Trey or Wen for ages. "You don't have an opportunity to work with me, because basically you just shut me out of everything." Finally, the truth came out.
"I'll never work with you," he blurted angrily. "You blackballed me."
"What are you talking about?" I said.
"When I was trying to get a job here, you blackballed me. Do you know how humiliating it was for my references to be called a second time?"
That's when I realized somebody had, for whatever reason, shared a negative reference on him from when he was applying to work at Kleiner. The feedback included a list of what I'd been told about how he did not work well with his teammates, and why he hadn't been offered a permanent job at Google. It was supposed to be confidential. "Calling a reference isn't blackballing," I said. "You worked at Google. Kleiner asked me to find out what your experience there was like. I didn't know you. Why would I blackball you? I had no idea who you were. They asked me to do a reference check. I did the reference check. It came back negative. And anyway, no one cared. You're here." As he was leaving my office, he muttered under his breath,
"Bottom quartile of interactions."
"What?" I asked. He didn't reply. Later, I asked Trey and Wen about Chihua's comments, and they both laughed them off. Trey said Chihua was a much bigger problem for her than I could ever be. She said a different partner had also been hassling her and had threatened that she should watch out or she would have tire tracks on her back. It felt like the whole firm was fracturing. We had gotten to critical mass with 7 women investing partners after a few years, but now the firm was breaking into smaller decision groups, with 1 woman per group. All the gains that had been made in hiring in the past few years were now diluted and less impactful, as women were even less included. And I continued to have a huge problem with Ajit. Ever since I'd broken things off with him, he had been leaving me out of meetings and off emails. But now that he was in a position of power over me and was giving me and my work negative reviews, that problem was a major liability.
I suspected he was trying to make it impossible for me to do my job well so he could push me out. John was superficially supportive when I discussed this with him, noting that he had noticed that Ajit had become more negative toward me both when I got married and when I gave birth to my daughter. John emailed me. I'd rather not write much about Ajit. As you suggest, it might be better to talk about Ajit. Ajit has caused our partnership, me, and particularly you, a lot of pain. And yet, when push came to shove, nothing was done. Between 2007 and 2009, I made several verbal and written complaints about Ajit as he continued to block my work. After one such complaint, the firm asked me to move offices to the back of the building, with the empty guest offices, so Ajit could move to a bigger office across the hall from my current one. When I said I didn't think sticking me in the boonies away from the corridors of power would solve the problem, they suggested I transfer to the China office. In my annual self-review, submitted in the summer of 2009, I called out Ajit's repeated undermining and said, "How do you suggest I work with Ajit? If at all?" It wasn't a joke. I wanted to know. If they were being stonewalled at every turn the way I was, what would they do? I really needed their guidance. I'd learned from them how to negotiate, how to find amazing entrepreneurs and startups, how to recruit an incredible team, how to put together a first-rate term sheet, and dozens of other skills and experiences. Now I came to them asking them to do something about the first management problem I'd ever encountered that I couldn't get around. And not only didn't they help me, they acted as though I were being, for want of a better word, irrational. One person on John's team that I trusted enough to ask for advice on how to solve this problem told me frankly, "Ellen, you are now the problem." In August of 2009, Kleiner's HR consultant told me to stop talking about it and said, "You will never succeed at Kleiner." I felt more and more alienated from the partners. One night I was heading out to an evening meeting after saying goodnight to my daughter. I'd stolen a few minutes with her after dropping off my car on an already long day. Waiting at the elevator bank of my apartment building were two of my coworkers.
"Are you coming with us?"
one of them asked me.
"Coming where?"
I asked back.
"I live here."
"To the Al Gore dinner,"
he explained. Apparently, Al Gore, who lived in my building when he was in the Bay Area, was hosting a dinner at his apartment.
"No,"
I replied. This was the first I'd heard of it. Not since junior high school had I felt such a painful social punch in the gut. Al Gore, a Kleiner Perkins strategic partner and neighbor of mine, was hosting a dinner at Kleiner's request. The guests were all men from the office and CEOs. I wasn't invited. As I walked across the street outside, I saw Mike McHugh, the Flipboard CEO I'd been working closely with, driving by in his car. He rolled down his window and said he needed to find parking but would be there soon. I told him about the valet at the building and let him know I wasn't joining. I went to my dinner meeting. When I told Buddy about the snub, he was protective and angry. As soon as he could find another apartment, he told me, he would be moving us out of that building. But there were limits to what he could fix. In the spring of 2011, I started voicing concerns again. I told Juliet I was not given opportunities to succeed. She responded that the growing firm was not a great fit for my quiet thoughtfulness. Or, unfortunately, she added, for women in general. When I shared my concerns with John, including about the all-male dinners and women's exclusion from interviewing partner candidates, I got a meager response. The last interviews I had been involved in had been for a search led by an outside recruiter for another junior partner in 2009. And the interview spreadsheet confirmed the firm's bias. Only 3 out of the approximately 37 candidates on the list were women, and only 2 women were invited to interview. The notes contained information regarding the candidates' gender, age, marital status, race, and ethnicity. The Kleiner partner's written feedback on one candidate indicated that she was very strong and had important skills and knowledge missing from the team, but added that she was rejected because of her age. She wasn't much older than me, but was a lot older than the firm's coveted 26-year-old target hire. The reasons for passing on the second woman were equally troubling. She was very much liked by the team, but too Eastern European. At around the same time, I was interviewing CEO candidates for one of John's companies. There was some vagueness about why one otherwise strong candidate had left his last role. We were trying to dig in, with little success. It seemed as if the candidate may have been involved in some form of harassment at the firm, but it wasn't clear how. I had a good relationship with the other VC involved in the search, and so I asked him how he thought about it. He told me that in all the years he'd been a CEO, only two employees had raised discrimination or harassment issues at his company. "It was interesting," he said, "because the two incidents were reported only a week apart. The first person, it was clear it was true. She had told two other people in the company, which obviously you would do if you were harassed. We got rid of the guy. But the second one? It came after a bad performance review. She had never told anybody she worked with before that. So it was clearly false." I just about had a heart attack. "Holy shit," I thought. "I haven't told any of my peers about Ajit blackballing me after we broke up. And my experiences were true. So maybe I should go tell some people." I ended up telling two women partners and Randy. The first woman was super supportive. I liked her because she was always direct and straight with me. And she had shared helpful advice since I started at Kleiner, ranging from explanations on how Kleiner worked to parenting advice and even book recommendations when I had my daughter. Talking about Ajit was awkward, but afterward I actually felt better that I had told someone in the office. The second person was Randy, the culture guru and my mentor. He told me he didn't have any advice for me and not to mention it again. "I never heard this," he said as he folded his arms and pursed his lips. So I went to fellow junior partner Trey Vassallo. Telling her opened up a longer conversation. Trey had been a gymnast and was very hardworking. She was enthusiastic about everything, cheerful and willing to do everything asked of her. Well, almost. We often were the last to leave the office at night, so we'd chat about our projects, our families, our health, our struggles in the office. She and I commiserated about how difficult it was to work with Randy, his need to take credit and companies, his difficulty connecting with CEOs, his my way or the highway approach to compromise, and his political nature. She had warned me about working with Ted. He didn't share information, was dismissive of her, and wasn't worth trying to form a working relationship with because he just wasn't interested. Those conversations made me feel like I could trust Trey. When I told her about Ajit, she grew uncharacteristically quiet. Then she said something I never expected. She had been harassed by Ajit too. She had fretted that it was her fault, and she was still very upset more than a year later. When Ajit had asked her out for drinks to talk shop, she had been happily pregnant, though hadn't announced it yet. But in the course of the evening, he started touching her with his leg under the table. Then I said something I still feel bad about. I recommended that she shouldn't report it, because I'd reported and had a hard time ever since, and they didn't do anything anyway. Fortunately, Trey didn't take my advice. She reported Ajit's behavior soon after, when she found out Ajit was about to do her review. He had stacked the review with people who didn't know her work well. She also saw what he'd been doing to me since I'd rejected him. She told Ray and Juliet that she'd rebuffed Ajit and was concerned that he would take revenge on her via her review. They didn't do anything, and mollified her by promising to keep an eye on it. In that round of summer reviews, Kleiner had six junior partners who had worked there for four or more years. The women, Trey, Risa Stack, and I, had twice as many years at Kleiner and twice as much total work experience as the men, Wen, Chi Hua, and Amol Deshpande. The men were all promoted, and none of the women were even considered for promotion. Though Trey and I continued to work hard and to hold out hope that things would turn around. Then, around the end of November, Ajit told Trey that he needed her to go to New York with him for a big due diligence trip. He sent emails about a dinner with a well-known CEO who might be able to help one of Trey's companies. But when they arrived in New York, Trey saw that the table was set for two at dinner. She learned that no CEO was coming. The trip was just her and Ajit, in a hotel together for the weekend. When she realized what he had planned, she left the restaurant. Later that night, he came to her hotel room in his bathrobe and banged on the door, asking to be let in. Aghast, she eventually had to physically push him out the door. She still seemed traumatized when she told me about her experience a month later, after our December off-site. She said she thought he might be a sociopath. I felt terrible guilt that I had told her not to report him in the first place, and I was glad she'd ignored my advice and spoken up about it. I also felt guilty that I hadn't pushed the firm to get rid of him when I'd realized what kind of guy he was. At the end of our December off-site discussion, Ray had asked Trey and me, two of the few women there, to copy notes onto the whiteboards. She refused angrily, and I stood frozen. I thought, it's so awkward, I should just do it. But Trey is right. Why didn't they ask any of the more junior men to do it? I don't want to weaken her statement by papering over the conflict, but I also want it to stop being awkward. So, while I stared, zombie-like, at Trey, trying to decide what to do, Mary Meeker, one of the only senior women at Kleiner and a celebrity in the tech world, filled the awkward pause by grabbing a marker. A note about Mary. If someone ever says that Kleiner, the VC world, or the finance world is biased against women, he or she should be prepared to hear this. Oh yeah? What about Mary Meeker? She came from investment banking, from Morgan Stanley, no less. She did really well there, even as they were sued for discrimination by other women. She's never publicly, or privately that I know of, been an advocate for women. She just has never talked about her gender. One time I asked her for advice. Randy blocked me from a board seat at this company, I said. He said it was because I went on maternity leave. Now Kleiner is having these all-male dinners with CEOs and power players, and we're not invited. Forget about the dinners, she said. Focus on the board seat. That's what matters. I didn't argue with her. The last time I'd heard about a woman arguing with her, Mary came back at her so forcefully that the woman ended up in tears. And I did take her advice. I tried to fight for board seats. But I couldn't help believing that those dinners mattered too. The longer I stayed in VC, the more I came to believe that all of it mattered. That even the seemingly insignificant jokes or slights were part of a system that maintained the status quo. I think the fact that Mary's tremendous success is so remarked upon only proves the point. She is a very special exception to a very entrenched rule. In the parking lot as we left the off-site meeting, Trey pointed out to John that only women were asked to do grunt work, were put in the back of the room, and weren't being asked to give presentations like the male junior partners. I wanted to cheer and applaud.
You guys should make a list of all these things and get the women together and talk about them, John said.
John, I said, that would be preaching to the choir. If we had gotten together, though, it would have been a long conversation. In addition to women being assigned menial tasks, we were often talked over and interrupted. When we were able to get a word in, we were ignored. If someone liked our ideas, they would repeat them and get credit. Our opportunities were fewer, like the one investment per fund rule that bound women but not men. Often, even those few investment opportunities were taken from us, especially if we took maternity leave. We were given less credit for our experience. At trial, it came out that my 4 years in corporate acquisitions and 5 years at Kleiner were ignored. So I was credited with 0 years of investing experience when promotion decisions were being made in July 2011, while Wen got full credit for investing experience for 5 years of management consulting, in addition to his time at Kleiner. Our annual performance reviews cast us as poor team players when we tried to claim credit for our work. And our reviewer lists were often stacked with people who were biased against us. We weren't invited to meetings, included on emails, asked to interview candidates, selected for hiring committees. We had the seats in the back of the room, the offices in the outer reaches, the non-speaking roles at off-sites and conferences. And we were certainly not promoted. A big part of the problem was that we did not have people championing us for opportunities and promotions as the men did. And we weren't given clear goals or requirements for promotion. Whenever I compared notes with Trey and Risa on what we were being told by the managing partners, the messages were different and often conflicting. When we got back to the office after the off-site, Trey gave me an earful about Ajit, about the firm, and about the failures of the managing partners and our ersatz HR leader to do anything. When she'd first reported her concerns about Ajit to Kleiner a year earlier, they told her, just as they told me, that if he did anything more, he would be out. So she went to them and disclosed the fake New York trip. Far from its being the final straw, one of the managing partners suggested, "You should feel flattered." After that conversation, I finally had clarity on the whole situation. For years, partners had promised to build a better culture, to prevent Ajit from harassing women, to help everyone succeed, and to live up to their goal of Kleiner being a meritocracy. I had come to believe that they were unwilling to have the conversations and take the difficult actions to fix these problems. Instead, they made promises to mollify us. Promises I'm not sure they ever intended to keep. I heard the HR consultant's words, "You will never succeed." And the team member's words, "You are now the problem." And I realized they were right. But now I found it empowering. If they'd thought I was a problem before, I decided, they were going to see what a real problem they had created. I told Trey I would talk with the COO and suggested that she do the same. He had been a public company CFO, and I thought he would understand the severity of the situation and quickly clean up the firm by getting rid of Ajit once and for all. On January 4, 2012, I sent an email to the COO and managing partners to try to reach a solution, even if that meant my leaving the firm. In my memo, I presented all the facts as clearly as I could. I care deeply about our firm and our partners, particularly about John, who has been a mentor to me throughout my 6.5 years here. I care about the working environment our firm fosters for our partners and our ventures. I believe that the treatment to which I and other women have been subject continues to this day and is carried out not only by Ajit, but by our firm more broadly. If you can, imagine your wife or daughter in my position and what it feels like to be deceived and intimidated into having a relationship with someone who flouts his seniority, immediately ending it after learning of the deception and finally standing up to the ongoing intimidation, and then reliving and being reminded of the whole thing by repeated episodes, including but not limited to being directly removed from business opportunities and projects with little or no explanation, having promises of board membership reneged on, having Ajit and others go behind my back with CEOs I was working with as a board member and lead partner, and having my performance evaluations plummet with a primary negative feedback on getting along with other partners. The regard in which women are generally held at our firm is also reflected in the hiring and rapid advancement of men over women, of equal or greater tenure, accomplishments, experience, and capabilities, the relegation of women to menial tasks, and the express exclusion of women from events. Our firm is less effective because of how it disregards women, particularly on these types of issues, but also on investments. I concluded with a request for an open dialogue on solutions, and for either protection from further ostracism or help with an exit. I was wrong in assuming Kleiner would take immediate action. After more than a month, the company responded to Trey's and my complaints by putting Ajit on leave, but he continued to participate in meetings anyway, as if he were still there. The managing partners didn't do anything about it. I learned that Ajit was negotiating for a gigantic severance package. Ultimately, after 2 tense months, he did leave. He was able to negotiate for compensation while being kicked out. But my experience as an ongoing employee had been so different. In 2009, I had mentioned to John that I was unhappy that my compensation wasn't in line with what the men around me were getting. I'd been promised the world when he hired me, and again when I'd tried to quit in 2007. But it hadn't happened. I'd thought my request to John was professional and reasoned. John didn't agree. In fact, he yelled at me in person. He told me that asking for more compensation wasn't a good look. He punctuated his message with an email. "I strongly recommend you stop complaining about your compensation. Just drop it. It clearly still bugs you, and that attitude of yours is A, no secret, and B, damaging to your standing among our firm's leaders." That was in 2009. For almost 3 years, his response had intimidated and shamed me into silence, to the point where I said nothing even when I was denied any share of profits in our next fund, while all the men working on the fund were allocated carry worth at least several million dollars. But now it was 2012. I was sick of being patient. Not only weren't things changing, the arrogance seemed to be at a new high. I found out the partners had taken some CEOs and founders on an all-male ski trip, a total boondoggle. They spent $50,000 on the private jet back and forth to Vail, several $100s per person on ski condos, at least $300 for each ski jacket, not including lift tickets, private ski instructors, meals, drinks, and massages. Chihua later explained that they didn't invite any women, because women probably wouldn't want to share a condo with men. I wondered what other all-male events had taken place that I hadn't even heard about. From time to time, the firm would try holding women-centric events, but they often felt a little half-hearted. We would meet at Juliet's house or senior partner Beth Seidenberg's house after work for cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. One time we met to celebrate Trey's pregnancy, but Juliet forgot to invite Trey until the day of the shower, and she wasn't available. Still, there was no sexual harassment or discrimination policy or training at Kleiner. Still no effort to make the culture more diverse or inclusive. Still, I felt like years of my life had been wasted. Again, I thought of Sheryl Sandberg's speech encouraging women in the business world to demand our place at the table and to ask for pay equity. The strategy hadn't gone well for me so far in VC, but I was determined to keep trying. When I spoke to the COO again, he asked how much I wanted in order to quietly leave. I suspected it would take around $10 million to wake up the firm and prevent future problems, and I imagined that was in the ballpark of what Ajit would be given. And I knew that amount wouldn't break them, but would hurt. They were billionaires, and routinely loaned out amounts like $18 million. That's the equivalent of $1,800 if you have $100,000, or $180 if you have $10,000. It's annoying, but it won't wreck you. "I want no less than what Ajit gets," I said. The COO gasped. Life at Kleiner got progressively worse. I was left out of meetings and decisions, and I had no recourse. Kleiner threatened to take away all my carry, even carry I had already earned over the past 7 years, If I did not sign documents they would later use to try to throw out my lawsuit. Bill Campbell, my coach and mentor who had said nothing but nice things about my performance to me and to the Kleiner team in mentoring meetings, informed me through his administrative assistant that I wouldn't be on his schedule that year. He had just touted me at the offsite as an example of a great board member from my work with Flipboard, a big help to the CEO and to the company, and to him in his role as an unofficial fellow board member. Finally, weeks after my letter, I was told that an outside independent investigator would look into Trey's complaint. I was told to meet with him as soon as you are able so that the investigation can proceed expeditiously. I asked for assurances that I would not be retaliated against, but didn't get a reassuring response before they closed the investigation. A few weeks later, that same investigator looked into the issues I'd raised in my January 2012 memo and called for a meeting. His interview was, from my perspective, a joke. I had heard that the so-called independent investigator wanted to get a job representing Kleiner as an HR attorney, and was hoping to work there after the investigation. So he was far from neutral. Almost all of the women came to me after their interviews and said the same thing. He really didn't ask questions. He asked if we had ever seen porn in the office. He seemed to solicit no real information about discrimination, bias, or harassment. At one point, when I mentioned that my colleagues had talked about a porn star when we were on a plane together, the investigator asked if it was Sasha Gray. I said no. He pressed the point, saying that Sasha Gray was crossing over into legitimate acting. I said she wasn't who they were talking about. But still, he seemed to really want to talk about Sasha Gray and her career. This went on for 10 minutes. Is this sexual harassment investigator really describing a porn star's work to me under the guise of interviewing me about the culture here? I thought. At another point, after I had gone through all the problems with how other women and I were treated by Kleiner, the investigator asked in a gotcha tone, "Well, if they look down on women so much, if they block you from opportunities, they don't include you at their events, why do they even keep you around in the first place?" I hadn't thought about it before. I replied slowly as the answer crystallized in my mind. If you had the opportunity to have a bevy of workers who were overeducated, underpaid, and well-experienced, that you could dump all the menial tasks you didn't want to do on, that you could get to clean up all the problems, and that you could create a second class out of, wouldn't you want them to stay? I noticed he didn't write that down in his notebook. Among the other things the investigator did not write down, that when women went on maternity leave, companies were permanently taken away from them. That when I first came back from maternity leave, daily 6:30 a.m. meetings were set up whose only purpose seemed to be to haze me. I dutifully showed up every morning. Fortunately, my nanny was willing to come to my house at 5:30 a.m. and I could afford to pay her extra. That Juliet told me she considered Ajit a sex addict, suggesting that perhaps Trey and the admin and I weren't crazy, or that perhaps she knew about other incidents. I walked out of the interview thinking, this is puppet theater. And still there was no sexual harassment training, no handbook, no rules, no HR person at Kleiner. Not even a line in the hiring paperwork saying, "Hey, be appropriate. Don't do things that make people feel uncomfortable. Don't touch people." Kleiner's managing partners flouted hiring rules too, asking inappropriate questions in interviews throughout my time at Kleiner, like, "Are you married? Do you have kids? How old are you? Are you thinking about having kids? What does your husband do? What did your ex-husband do?" It was noted at some point that asking all these questions created a giant legal risk. And the response was, effectively, "Well, who's going to sue us?" Weeks more passed with no response about what the investigation had found. with every day without news of the investigation. I knew I was right. Around Valentine's Day, John and I had a mediation meeting with our lawyers at a hotel. John ordered the lawyers to sit away from us, and he kept yelling about various perceived offenses. It seemed to bother him that it was formal and now the firm had to deal with it. Finally, after weeks had passed with no news of any changes, I told John I was filing a claim with the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, based on the lack of responsiveness of the firm to my years of claims, the poor quality of the investigation into the serial harassment and related retaliation, the lack of a response in the form of any kind of sexual harassment policy, and the bigger issues of culture and inclusion that were being ignored. That was in March 2012. I quietly filed a lawsuit directly against Kleiner in May. I saw the lawsuit described in the press several days later. I suspected that Chihua, who had just been on a conference panel with a reporter, leaked the story himself. Meanwhile, Kleiner had notified me that their investigation was done. The finding was that there had been no retaliation or discrimination. In response to my suit, Kleiner hired a powerful crisis management PR firm. Companies hire them when the shit hits the fan. These firms can be paid to do things that you don't want to do. And Brunswick was known for it. On their website, they bragged about having troll farms, integrated networks of influence, used in part for reputation management. And I believe they enlisted one to defame me online. Dozens, then thousands of messages a day derided me as bad at my job, crazy, an embarrassment. This company that I had given years of my life to, that I had made millions for, was crucifying me publicly. Repeatedly, Kleiner was quoted as calling me a poor performer. On their website, they said I was making false allegations and unfounded claims. And they went out of their way to criticize me to the press, leading to a slew of negative publicity that would culminate in an online Vanity Fair hit piece insinuating that Buddy was gay, a fraud, and a fake husband. Everywhere I looked, strangers on the internet were calling me a bad employee. Look at the praise I got before I complained, I imagined telling them. They were calling my marriage a sham. Tell that to our baby, I thought. Even in the sonogram, she looked like Buddy. They said I was money-grubbing. Can you name anyone in the venture capital industry who is less money-grubbing than I am? I wanted to ask these writers. I work almost every waking minute, and I can't even remember the last time I bought anything for myself. Everyone I work for has multiple jets. I tried to stay focused on my personal life. Buddy and I were over the moon that our daughter was so happy and healthy, and that, after a lot of trying, I was pregnant with our second child. Still, the negativity wore me down. I was so tired. And the barrage of anger was so relentless that I began to sleep even less than usual. I barely ate. I kept going to work day after day, even though I knew most of the partners didn't want me there. I was invited to fewer and fewer meetings and sent fewer and fewer emails. I spent almost all my time in the office alone, except for Monday meetings and occasional visits from people outside Kleiner. The general partners sometimes had long meetings to discuss the lawsuit while I was in the office. The 10 of them would file into one of the large windowed conference rooms. Through the clear glass, I could see them hunched around the table, looking annoyed as a team of lawyers blared over the speakerphone. If I walked down the hall, the room would fall silent and their eyes would follow me until I was out of sight. Partners would not greet me when we crossed paths, much less make eye contact. Hallway conversations would pause until I passed. When I sat down near coworkers, they would sometimes get up, gather their notebooks and coffee mugs, and move to other chairs. Trey and I moved our chats outside the office. We would leave 5 minutes apart so no one would know. Eventually, even that got too uncomfortable. That feeling of being unwanted, unwelcomed, and excluded was exceedingly painful. Then in June, during a regular pregnancy checkup, my doctor looked at the sonogram and I could tell something was wrong. He called me into his office and leaned across his big wooden desk to gently let me know that I'd had a miscarriage. When I saw all the horrible things being said about you, I was traveling in Russia, and I was worried about you and the baby, my doctor said, referring to an article in the New York Times earlier that month. The article harkened back to the Dark Ages. An expert was quoted saying he was skeptical about my claims because he hadn't ever heard of mistreatment of women in Silicon Valley. And anonymous sources asked why I didn't leave after such poor treatment. Stress can be a correlating factor, and you've certainly had plenty of that. I'm so sorry. I felt, in that moment, that Kleiner had taken everything from me. They had taken all my time and energy for 7 years. They had taken my dignity by refusing to listen to me. They had championed a man who had sexually harassed me and at least one or two other women, and had promoted him over us. Now I felt they had taken my chance to have another child. I wanted more than anything to leave that terrible place. Crumpled in my doctor's office, I also felt more determined to make things better for other women. I began to speak up in the office. Instead of smiling blankly, I pointed out when jokes were sexist. When a man attempted to take ownership of my deal, I told John and tried to give it to Trey. I felt good about the work I was doing. My investments were doing well. CEOs were happy with me. I was working as hard as ever. But my review that summer after I filed suit was not good at all. Ted and Matt sat me down.
"People are complaining about your board performance," Matt said.
"How can that be possible?" I asked, confused.
"You're a bad board member," Matt said.
"How?" I repeated, even more confused. "Bill Campbell called me out as an example of a great board member. I'm thinking of all the CEOs I work with and all the positive feedback I've been getting from them. Who said that I was a bad board member?"
"The CEOs," Matt responded curtly.
"Which ones?" I asked.
"All of them," said Matt.
I listed them one by one. People I knew to be my friends. People who had gone out of their way to praise my performance. People who knew I had fought for them. And he said yes to each. I asked for specific feedback, what they wanted me to do to be a better board member, or at least what I had done wrong. They could offer no details. Eventually, Ted promised to go back to the CEOs to get more actionable criticism. The only specific piece of feedback in the whole review was from Matt.
"Well, you should keep your meeting dates."
He was referring to the single meeting I'd canceled last minute through my admin in 7 years. I'd had to, as he knew, because I was in the hospital. I hadn't told him about the miscarriage, but he knew I had been taken dramatically and unexpectedly ill, and that it had been a medical emergency. After that review, I got in my car and drove to another part of the parking lot. I parked and opened the door. I sat there alone, doubled over, and dry-heaved. These men I'd worked with for years were trying to convince me that I was a bad employee, when I knew I wasn't. They were saying that all my CEOs thought I was a bad board member, when I knew for a fact that wasn't the case. I happened to know that a lot of people thought Ted and Matt were bad board members. I myself thought they were sometimes bad board members. But different rules seemed to apply to them. What hurt most was that the thing I'd always really loved about VC was working with the entrepreneurs and trying to be helpful and be supportive. I'd always been praised for that. They were even trying to take that away. If Ted and Matt had said something specific, like, You don't push hard enough on your CEOs. You coddle them.
I would have said, all right, I don't agree, but that's fair.
And that would have been something I could address. I could have taken a more direct, less encouraging management approach. If that's what I had been told to do, I would have made the change. When I was able, finally, to see my list of reviewers, I found that the people who reviewed me didn't match the names I'd given of those I had worked closely with. When I asked the HR consultant why, she said that some people were added because they had worked closely with me. When I asked why I wasn't asked to review them if we had worked so closely together, she was stumped. Among the new people assigned to review me was Chihua, who was still on the warpath because he believed I had blackballed him when he was an applicant. I could identify some of his feedback, as when he described me as too quiet. I was gratified to see that someone had added a parenthetical there. She gets visibly shut down and left out of conversations. Another piece of feedback noted that I had a female chip on my shoulder. I didn't know quite what that meant, but it sounded bad. Matt and Ted had given me no way to redeem myself. There was no path to victory, only pressure to leave, and to leave as a failure. My formal complaint did have one good outcome. For the first time in Kleiner's history, they finally offered a class in recognizing sexual harassment and discrimination. They brought in an anti-harassment trainer, a management-side lawyer, to do a workshop. They'd never had that kind of training before, so no one knew quite what to expect. As 25 or so partners filed into our largest conference room, John made a point of separating me from the person I'd sat down next to by rolling a chair over, shoving it between us, and positioning himself next to me. Our interactions were pretty non-existent by that point. Another managing partner, Bing, made a big deal of sitting next to Trey. What did they think we were going to do? Start a riot at harassment training? I just shook my head. The trainer started to talk. I wondered if he'd have trouble breathing given the thick fog of tension in the room. He began running through slides. On slide 5, he said we have an affirmative obligation to ensure the right kind of workplace. On slide 6, he said when there's a complaint, there needs to be a thorough investigation. On slide 7, he said no matter how much the offender produced on the business side, severe and pervasive harassment could not be allowed. We all dutifully had our notebooks and pens out as the trainer explained what it meant to create an inclusive environment. He gave examples of harassment ranging from groping interns to making sexual jokes. I had seen pretty much every single one of them since arriving in Silicon Valley. John kept looking at my notes. John raised his hand.
"If the attention is welcome," he asked slowly, pausing to draw out the question dramatically. "Is it still sexual harassment?"
The trainer answered his question as John wrote down, "Welcome equals not harassment." Slide 8 dealt with hiring. We learned it was illegal to discriminate based on things like race, sex, or age.
"So we really want people who are 26, another managing partner stated, paying no attention to the seriousness of the discussion. "How can we hire more 26-year-olds?
The partners were always obsessed with 26-year-olds. I think maybe it was because Larry Page and Sergey Brin of Google were around 26 when they met John. The trainer looked startled.
"You can't," he responded. "In hiring, you have to look for the best people. To discriminate on the basis of sex, race, or age just isn't legal."
"Okay," the partner tried again. "But what about a 26-year-old mindset? How do we guarantee they have that?"
You can't,"
the trainer repeated. I wanted to point out to them, "You're asking this lawyer to help you discriminate. Of course he's not going to give you advice on how to do it."
"But what if we ask them about things only 26-year-olds would know?"
the partner continued. Questions about the 26-year-old gold standard candidate continued.
No, no, you can't,
the trainer said uncomfortably.
We've got to move on.
If he hadn't ended the conversation, I swear we would still be there, discussing how to screen for 26-year-olds without being obvious that we were screening for 26-year-olds. Slide 12. The trainer talked about making assumptions about other people. For example, he said in the 1990s there was a problem with people thinking extreme weight loss in a coworker might mean he had AIDS.
I don't understand, a partner confessed. Why I can't just tell the recruiter to hire a 26-year-old?
The trainer looked aghast. He moved on to discussions of what constitutes a hostile work environment, why lunch is better than dinner for work meetings, and how important tone of voice and body language can be. Slide 21 covered coping with harassment. A partner asked, what if a female employee re-remembers an exchange and decides she was harassed after a bad performance review?
John wrote down, re-remembers.
That's rare, the trainer said. There is often something real there. People often feel genuinely aggrieved in these situations.
There are real bad actors out there, Trey offered. I don't know if everyone here knows how many bad actors there are.
But how can you prove there was a wink?
Someone said patronizingly.
The truth hangs together,
the trainer said. In big letters I wrote down, the truth hangs together, and drew a box around it. John looked at my notes and grimaced.
He was getting crankier and crankier as the hour went on.
Risa Stack, a junior partner, raised her hand and asked, if 10 people go to a strip club and don't bring one member of the team, specifically the only woman, is that allowed?
No,
the trainer replied.
In that scenario, the woman misses a business opportunity.
A few more scenarios like that were described, all of which we had lived through, and we learned that they were all officially either illegal or borderline.
You can ask out someone at work, the trainer said. But only do it once. Persistence in a work environment quickly looks like stalking.
Then there was a conversation about investigations, which he recommended be done by outsiders so they would be unbiased. I shook my head a little, thinking of how only biased people at Kleiner had been charged with looking into the Ajit situation. My filing also resulted in a sexual harassment policy for the company. Though it had a curious clause. It forbade us from telling one another about any discrimination or harassment. A partner said,
you have to tell people in authority, but you can't talk to one another about it.
Trey and I might never have formally complained unless we had known, through sharing our stories with each other, that there was a pattern of bad behavior going unchecked. Upon reviewing the clause, the trainer tried to explain that the problem wasn't people hearing about harassment, it was harassment happening in the first place. But that fell on deaf ears. Nothing seemed to shame them. The arrogance really got to me. I started noticing again that meetings were often sprinkled with racist jokes. Over time, I had just stopped paying attention to their so-called humor, but I started listening again. One day, we were talking about Voxer, a reimagined walkie-talkie company. Your phone could become like a walkie-talkie, but you could also email and text using your voice, with a better user experience than the usual voicemail. It was a new way for people to communicate and share messages. You could easily send a group voice message, so it was very powerful and most popular in urban settings.
Hey, Rodriguez,
Randy said in a horrible fake Mexican accent.
You got the job for me?
Yes, Aniqua,
quipped Chihua in his toughest voice.
And yet people wondered why no partner who might be named Shaniqua or Rodriguez ever worked there. For all the talk about how Kleiner was a family, women never seemed to succeed there. For all the company's pride about the women they'd brought in, Very few of them were happy, and almost none of them stayed. The Kleiner higher-ups acted as if the dearth of women was a huge mystery. Some people passed it off as biological. Others said it had something to do with maternal clocks, a burning desire to opt out. But I was in those rooms for nearly a decade, and I could have told them, if they had asked, why the women never lasted. It wasn't a mystery, and it had nothing to do with our unbridled desire for babies. The real reason was, the system is designed to keep us out. These are rooms full of white heterosexual men who want to keep acting like rooms full of white heterosexual men. And so either they continue to do so, creating a squirm-inducing experience for the rest of us, or they shut down when people of color or women enter the room and resent having to change their behavior. We are either silenced or we are seen as buzzkills. We are either left out of the social network that leads to power, the strip clubs and the steak dinners and the all-male ski trips, and so we don't fit in, or our presence leads to changes in the way things are done, and that causes anger, which means we still don't fit in. If you talk, you talk too much. If you don't talk, you're too quiet. You don't own the room. If you want to protect your work, you're not a team player. Your elbows are too sharp. You're too aggressive. If you don't protect your work, you should be leaning in. If you don't negotiate, you're underpaid. If you do negotiate, you're complaining. If you want a promotion, you're overreaching. If you don't ask for a promotion, you get assigned all the unwanted tasks. The same goes when asking for a raise. There is no way to win, and you're subject to constant gaslighting. When you stand up for yourself, there are 15 reasons why you don't deserve what you're asking for. You're whining. You don't appreciate what you have. There is the steady drumbeat of, "We let you in here even though you don't belong. Be grateful. Just drop it." The internal bias was also directed externally. One woman partner told me that she was reluctant to bring women CEOs in to pitch to Kleiner partners because she knew they faced much higher bars for investment. Two outsiders, including one male founder, complained to me about how Kleiner talked about women in a sexist way. Unfortunately, they're not the only ones. I've heard too many stories from women CEOs about their struggles to be treated fairly when asking VCs for funding. They get talked over, interrupted, ignored, leered at, and propositioned. And I've heard too many stories from men in those rooms, one of whom declared himself a feminist after watching his CEO beaten down in those conversations. One VC asked an entrepreneur to babysit his kids, and I am positive he's not the one in charge of childcare in his family. I felt confident that if anyone asked, I could suggest how to dismantle this Catch-22-based system, how to create an inclusive workplace, how to make it a real family. I would say that there has to be a path to victory for every kind of person, not just guys who like golf and skiing and good scotch, who all went to the same schools. I would say that you do business during business hours. You listen to each other. And you find ways to work as a team rather than as cutthroat competitors. You don't get rewarded for screwing over other people, especially the quietest or least connected people. And I would say that, at the bare minimum, when you have a man who is behaving in a predatory, manipulative fashion toward multiple women in your family, and you're hearing worrisome things about him over the course of several years, by God, you don't tolerate it. Every day, what I suspected and heard from others was confirmed. The only way change would ever happen was through the courts. I had dreaded the prospect of litigation. I hated it when I was a lawyer, and I hated the thought of doing it as a plaintiff. But I was also fed up. They just wouldn't listen to anything else. Even if I lost, I'd lose fighting for something I believed in. And maybe it would help someone else be listened to down the road. At the very least, I wouldn't feel so guilty the next time someone at Kleiner was sexually harassed. Research is what I do. It's always been my habit to overprepare. And so before I had filed my lawsuit, I talked to everyone I could. I spoke with 3 former Kleiner partners, including a founding partner, to find out what Kleiner's core values were and whether or not the current leaders embodied them. I didn't mention my own situation, but it became clear from the conversation that these longtime partners were not entirely impressed by the direction of the company, and that they had concerns about its culture and its chaotic growth. Leaving those conversations, I felt confident that I held the moral high ground and that I wasn't alone in seeing the problems at Kleiner. For years, I'd tried to believe in the story of Kleiner as a place where we were really trying to help entrepreneurs to build awesome companies and products. I believed that we were this team of people working together and that we were trying to be missionaries, not mercenaries. But eventually I'd come to see all that talk as a big lie. My parents raised me to believe that the world was a meritocracy, that if you worked hard enough, you could get ahead. But that wasn't true at Kleiner. It just wasn't fair. Before suing, I'd consulted with other women who had sued big, powerful companies over harassment and discrimination. I reached out to women at investment banks, some who had won, some who had lost, some who had settled, and one who had sued twice. They shared their stories, and I began to see patterns. They did well at their companies, but still they saw clients poached by male colleagues, especially during maternity leaves. They had to keep building up their books, only to see their best clients and profits taken from them. They worked harder and were paid less. New hires with less experience were given their territories. There was also harassment in the form of crude behavior or awkward passes. All these women who had sued gave me pretty much the same advice. Don't do it. One woman told me, "It is so hard. It is the worst thing. The system is terrible. It's a complete mismatch of resources. They don't fight fair. Even if you win, it will destroy your reputation." One woman, Renee Fassbender-Amacheyev, an investment advisor, told me she'd been miserable from the moment she filed her lawsuit. After she complained, she became an outcast and a target. Her co-workers started a petition to have her leave. Every morning she would get to the parking lot and throw up, and then she would enter the building and start her workday. Her name was dragged through the mud. They sent people to follow and photograph her and her family. "You have to prepare for it to be harder than you can even imagine," she said. "Do you regret it?" I asked. There was a pause. "No," she said. Part 3. Hitting Reset. Chapter 11. Clean out your desk. My filing was as simple as we could make it. Everything that had happened to me over 7 years at Kleiner was condensed into 12 double-spaced pages. My claim specified gender discrimination in promotion and pay, and retaliation, the poor treatment I received after reporting the harassment. I asked for damages to cover the lost pay and to prevent them from doing it again. It didn't take long for me to realize why nobody points out problems, much less files lawsuits. I'd given so much time and energy to Kleiner, but after I sent one formal memo, all the goodwill I'd built up vanished. When I eventually sued, suddenly things got tense and everyone had to pick a side. It was complicated and messy, and by local standards, tremendously uncool. My lawyer said my case would be stronger if I continued to work at Kleiner. And so, for several months after the memo in January 2012, and even after filing the lawsuit in May, I kept showing up to work around people who actively avoided and ignored me. If I'd thought getting anything done was hard before, it became pretty much impossible. The managing partner sent around 2 emails informing everyone about the lawsuit, A coworker showed me the first email but wouldn't send it to me. I assumed she was concerned about getting in trouble, and I didn't blame her. The gist was, Ellen is suing. She's upset because she wasn't invited to dinner with Al Gore. Save your emails. It made me sound crazy. Before and after I filed, Kleiner made 3 attempts to have the dispute mediated, to make it disappear quietly. They wanted to figure out a quick way to appease me and to carry on doing things exactly as they always had. Their arrogance and their confidence that my silence could be bought made me angry. I was appalled by their refusal to admit, despite their near total homogeneity, that they had any problem with diversity. From the beginning, Kleiner's main defense lawyer, Lynn Hermley of Oreck Law Firm, seemed to go out of her way to make my life a living hell. And she raised her voice in a menacing way whenever addressing me. Right off the bat, she intimated that she would shame me publicly for interviewing several lawyers as I tried to build my case. And she intimidated my friends and family. I had decided on a no collateral damage approach. I would avoid harm to Kleiner Partners' friends and family members, as they weren't directly responsible for the firm's problems. I would not put CEOs in the awkward position of having to protect or implicate their investor. Don't hurt the innocent, I thought. Kleiner had no such qualms. Lynn even attacked my friend Lori Park, one of the earliest engineers at Google, whom I'd met in 2005, saying she was fair game because she had sued a former employer. They didn't observe customs around privacy and used personal information from emails covered by marital and attorney-client privilege, including emails to my husband and my lawyers and even personal notes I'd taken during therapy. They planned to fight dirty. Their bullying approach and scare tactics made me even more determined to move forward. Thankfully, I had Buddy and our daughter at home, my sisters and my mom, and my friends outside work. And I had some money saved, which made some things easier. Because of my upbringing, I don't want much and usually don't spend much, and I was lucky to be earning a lot more than I spent, so I could save a good chunk of my paycheck. Once I realized that I still had to go to work at Kleiner every day after filing a formal complaint, I decided I would buy something for myself every 3 months as a goal and a reward. I usually don't need a carrot or a stick to motivate myself. I like to work, but these were tough times. And during these dark days, I wanted to find some way to be nice to myself. The first thing I bought was a Keith Haring Free South Africa print. A black figure on a leash about to stomp on the small white figure holding the leash. I had always loved its stark simplicity, bold graphics, and clear anti-apartheid message. 3 months later, I bought myself a small cross pendant, which I still wear every day. When I got anxious, I soothed myself by rubbing my thumb across the smooth back of the cross. Going to church every Sunday had become a grounding and inspiring part of my life, and I tried to carry that calmness with me through the week. Then I sensed I was about to lose my job, and I stopped spending money on myself. Though being fired wasn't a surprise, it still felt terrible. In October 2012, Matt called me into his office for our weekly one-on-one meeting. Only, when I walked in, I saw that Ted was sitting slightly behind him, awkwardly, and they were nervously laughing. That seemed like a bad sign. I sat down. "We'd like you to leave," Matt said. He paused for my reaction. I had none. "You haven't improved since your last review," he continued. "And we told you having to leave might be an outcome." "No, actually you didn't," I replied slowly and deliberately. I finally had nothing to lose, so I pushed back with the facts. "I specifically asked you what the outcomes might be, and you never said being forced to leave was one." Ted didn't say a word. I thought, improve how? You never gave me actionable items. You never came back with the feedback you promised from all the CEOs who you claim wanted me off their boards. If you'd ever told me what to change, I would have done it. All you've done is put obstacles in the way of me doing anything. And I've gone around them and found ways to make the company money. And still you say I didn't do it right. Then I sat quietly and listened, as Matt, now flustered, read through a document detailing the terms of my departure. The meeting lasted 15 minutes. My voicemail, he said, would remain live for 6 months, as would my email. I was told to be out of the office by the end of the day, and not to come back. Ted said nothing. It was already almost 4, so I only had a couple of hours before I would need to be out of the building for good. I went back to my office and started to pack. While I was there, boxing up a few books, Matt came rushing in, even more flustered. He announced that he'd forgotten something and told me a few more details of the exit. They were going to send a full written agreement to me through my lawyer. "You and Ted can't even fire me correctly," I thought as he left the room that was no longer my office. "You give advice to CEOs and executive teams all day long on how to run their companies and lead their teams,